Hello, I'm Will Starrett. This is number 0406, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0406. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet actress Gabrielle Stone, who stars in and makes her directorial debut in the short film It Happened Again Last Night. Did she enjoy directing?
I really loved directing. I definitely want to do it again in the future. The next thing I direct, I don't want to be in front of the camera. I think it's definitely a lot to wear both hats, especially when you're on an indie budget and timeline. But I really enjoyed it. It was a really great opportunity to really get things the way you want them and to have your hands fully into a project. And it turned out great. I couldn't be happier with it.
Tristan Donovan, author of It's All a Game, the history of board games from Monopoly to Settlers of Catan.
Board games have this great big history over hundreds of years. Monopoly had this intriguing history where it started as a sort of anti-capitalist game almost, then changed into sort of almost a celebration of capitalism. So there was lots of kind of stories behind board games that made them quite intriguing, and I wanted to sort of dig into it and find out more about how they had lasted so long. So they've been around longer than the written word.
Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and Book Banter takes a look at Dave's world. David Letterman, that is. In the new biography, Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. So get that viewer mailbag ready. It's all happening soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0406 was Will Starrett, president and CEO of Rock Castle Media Networks. Now, they provide programming to radio stations across the United States and Canada, and you can reach them online at rockcastlemedia.com. That's rockcastlemedia.com. Thank you very much, Will, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Apparently, there isn't much to do for thrills in Mississippi. That might be why a young man and two women went to the deck of a public bar to have a little three-way. Now, Triple D's restaurant and bar was closed when the owner drove up to take care of some business. She was a little surprised to find a man and two women having sex on a deck that overlooks the Jordan River. She immediately called the sheriff's deputies, and deputies saw the man and one of the women engaging in sexual activity. Right there in the middle of the day, in broad daylight, in front of God and everybody, Sheriff Ricky Adams said. I'd hate to have to tell Mama and Daddy I got arrested for such as that. Okay. Adam said they were each arrested on a charge of indecent exposure and misdemeanor. Well, heinous as the act might have been, clearly it was a little overwhelming for religious mama's boy Sheriff Ricky. I mean, let's clarify some facts. Yes, this sex act took place in broad daylight, but is it any revelation that it was in front of God? I mean, God is all-knowing, all-seeing, and is everywhere. If you're having sex in an underground bunker at midnight, theoretically God's still there too, so bringing up the deity is kind of a moot point. Secondly, Sheriff Ricky said, and I quote, "I hate to have to tell Mama and Daddy I got arrested for such as that." While one participant was 19 years old, the other two were 26 and 30, I don't think Mama and Daddy are a big issue here. I think I'm more curious right now about what Sheriff Ricky hasn't told his Mama and Daddy. Yeah. There are a lot of things a person might want to smuggle into a courthouse. Video recording equipment, a bottle of booze, a gun. But one Michigan woman felt she could not make it through a day in court without her monkey. Former Bay City resident Linda Stevenson visited the Bay County Court facility and put her purse on the X-ray machine at the building's security station. "I pushed the button for it to go through when it started making noises," said Bay County Sheriff's Court Security Deputy Pat McIver. "I was like, what was that?" And she goes, "Oh, that's my monkey." If I had a nickel for every time I heard that. The X-ray captured an image of the diminutive simian skeleton within Stevenson's purse. "I said, I need to see your monkey," McIver said. Again, if I had a nickel. She unzipped her purse. The monkey stuck its head out and looked around, and then she zipped it back up. McIver told Stevenson she could not bring the monkey into the building. She returned him to her car, then quickly conducted her small claims-related business inside the courthouse. After her business was concluded, Stevenson was stopped by McIver on the way out and was asked to bring the monkey back inside for some of the other courthouse staff to see him. Stevenson obliged, bringing the monkey back into the security station. She opened her bag and the monkey climbed out on her arm, then climbed up onto my arm and across my shoulder, McIver said. When she instructed the primate to return to her purse, he did as instructed. "He's amazing," Stevenson said about the monkey, adding she takes him everywhere with her. Well, that would be an interesting opening line in a bar, wouldn't it? "Excuse me, would you like to see my monkey?" And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Okay, sometimes, you know, you don't need the whole story to get the gist. Sometimes, just the headline will do. So, here are a series of headlines you can ponder, and if you really, really want to chase down the stories, well, you can do that on your own time. Recent alarming headlines. Number one, UK woman who urinated on Trump golf course loses case. That was from London. Number two, fish thief on unicycle busted by DNR. That's the Department of Natural Resources. That story came from Battle Creek, Michigan. And from the Northwest Florida Daily News, that's in Fort Walton Beach, all on the same day, we have four of them. Then again, it is Florida, but they're all on the same day. Number one, man throws fork at woman in fight over dog poop. Number two, senior citizen punches husband for taking Lord's name in vain. Number three, two people busted for creating fake football league, lawmen say. And number four, man denies defecating in parking lot despite officer witnessing deed. Yep. All the news that's fit to print. Wow. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Actress Gabrielle Stone is back on the program with us. We spoke to her about 4 years ago when she starred in the film Speak No Evil. Well, she's been busy since then. Recently, she made her directorial debut with the short film It Happened Again Last Night, a project that she also stars in. It has done well on the festival circuit, earning Gabrielle two Best Actress awards so far. And she joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Gabrielle.
Hello. How is everybody?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks once again for doing this. Nice to talk to you on the program once again. You have been very busy, as I said. This was your directorial debut in a movie that you're starring in. What was more difficult for you, directing Gabrielle or taking direction from Gabrielle?
I really loved directing. I definitely want to do it again in the future. The next thing I direct, I don't want to be in front of the camera. I think it's definitely a lot to wear both hats, especially when you're on an indie budget and timeline. But I really enjoyed it. It was a really great opportunity to really get things the way you want them and to have your hands fully into a project. And it turned out great. I couldn't be happier with it.
As I mentioned, you've won two so far, two Best Actress Awards on the festival circuit. Which two festivals were they in?
So we've screened at 3 festivals, and we have luckily won awards at all 3 of them. The first one was Pasadena Film Festival, where I won Best Actress, which was phenomenal. We were also nominated for Best Short. And then we went to North Hollywood Cinefest, and we won Best Short at that festival. And then we screened at the Beverly Hills Film Festival, which is an Academy-qualifying, very prestigious festival that screens at the Chinese Man Theaters out in Hollywood. And we won not only Best Short of the entire festival, but also Best Actress, and I was competing against, you know, feature film actresses. And it was a really big shock for me and a really big honor.
Is there a possibility that this film could make it all the way to the short film category at the Oscars?
Yes, because we won the top award for a short film at Beverly Hills, which was Academy qualifying, we're now eligible to submit it to the Oscars. So we will definitely be doing that later this year.
Wow. So tell us, what is the film It Happened Again Last Night? What is it about?
The film is about Paige, who I play, and she is a woman who is trapped in an abusive relationship with a man, and she has fallen in love with her best friend, who is a female. So the film, it's centered heavily around domestic violence between her and the boyfriend that she's with, and it also explores a lot of themes in the LGBTQ community, really trying to own who you are and be comfortable in your own skin, no matter what that looks like. It's definitely a drama, and we see how she handles the situation and if she's able to get out or not.
Now, in addition to being an actress and a director, you're also a writer. Did you have a hand in this as well?
I did. I originally wrote this when I was scheduled to go shoot a really big film, and the funding fell through like 2 days before I was getting on a plane. So I had 3 weeks of my life booked out, and I was like, well, I need to do something. So I ended up writing the first version of this, which is very different than what we ended up shooting. And then I brought my co-director on, and we co-wrote, co-produced, and co-directed this. And that individual is Rose, who directed me in Speak No Evil, which is when I originally spoke to you.
Was there any situation, either personally in your life or with friends or something that was in the news, that led you to write this particular story?
No, thankfully I have never experienced anything as horrible as this is, but I do feel that domestic violence is such a huge issue in our world, and our industry doesn't, you know, shine enough light on it all the time. I also, in the relationship between the two females in the film, I feel that a lot of times in cinema, the gay or lesbian characters are the supporting characters and, you know, not really in the leading role. And I wanted to portray not necessarily that she was identifying herself as a lesbian or gay, just that she is a human being that happened to fall in love with another human being, regardless of the sex. Because I think too often in our society, we really put labels on people and, you know, put them into boxes and decide what to categorize them as. And I feel like the more we can just see people as people and accept them that way, the better.
There is a lack of female directors in mainstream films today. Do you think the success of your directorial debut and a short film category has opened eyes to people thinking, maybe we should give Gabriella a shot at something bigger?
I hope so, and I don't know what project is going to speak to me enough to be the one that I want to direct next, but I definitely know that the networking at the festivals that I've done and the attention that's been brought from the short, that opportunity will hopefully be coming soon.
What's next for you? I understand you got a film coming out, Rock, Paper, Dead. Is that right?
Yeah, I have 3 films coming out this year. The first is Rock, Paper, Dead, which is a horror film directed by Tom Holland, who, you know, did Fright Night and Child's Play. And that stars Luke McFarlane, Tatum O'Neill, Michael Madsen. And it's a really fun twist on the serial killer. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun when it hits theaters. It's definitely going to be one for the horror fans to go check out. And then I also have a romantic comedy coming out later this year called The Competition, And that stars Chris Klein and Thora Birch. And I play a stripper in that and had an absolute ball doing it. And then the last one is a feature festival drama called Swell, directed by Justin Lee. And it's probably one of the most proud things I've done thus far in my career.
And why is that?
It's a really... It was a jump for me because my character in it, although it's a drama, had a lot of comedic things woven into it. And I've never identified as someone that does comedy until this project. So it was really empowering for me as an actress. It also, on the flip side, was one of the hardest shoots I've ever done. We started in Santa Cruz and traveled all the way up to Astoria, Oregon. And we were really on a legit road trip. And the cast and I just got so close, and we had so many hurdles to get over, and it was a really just emotional film, and it really translated to what we ended up capturing on screen.
You have been able, it seems, to chart your own path in the business in a situation where not a lot of young women have had an opportunity to do so. Is the fact that you come from a Hollywood pedigree, your father was Christopher Stone, your mother Dee Wallace Stone, does that help because you grew up with a knowledge of what the business of Hollywood was all about as opposed to just the glamour of it?
You know, I think it benefits me in the sense that I grew up on set. I was immersed in the industry. I knew, I saw how it worked, and I have a lot of knowledge about it. I don't think it helps as far as, you know, where my career is at now. My mom and I joke all the time that she wishes she could just pick up a phone and call someone and get me a big part in something. It's not that way. It might be for other offsprings of industry people, but it hasn't been in my sense. But it's definitely shaped who I am as an actress to be able to carve out my own path and moving forward for sure.
Okay, so as a writer and a director, has your mom come to you yet and said, honey, when are you going to put me in a film?
Funny you should ask. We just partnered with a writer-director to do a festival drama that both of us will star in. So I won't be writing or directing, although I have had my my head in coming up with the idea and the outline and the storyline, working with the writer on that. But yeah, we just started like the early development stages of putting that together. So we've never played in a feature, you know, film, a mother-daughter where we're both able to star. And I think we're both ready to kind of tackle that and do that now in our careers.
Well, we look forward to that. In the meantime, how can people have an opportunity to see It Happened Again last night?
So we're still in our festival run, so unless we are coming to a festival that they are nearby to, that would be the only way right now. But we were approached by a distribution company, so I know that once we finish our festival run, we will be getting it out some way. But the best way to keep up with everything is to find the film on Facebook, just type in It Happened Again last night, and like the page, and all the updates will be on there.
Excellent. And I'm sure people can find information on your website as well.
Yes, everything's on my website and all my social media stuff. It's all interconnected, so I'm at Gabrielle Stone on pretty much every platform.
Great. We've had your mom on this program several times, so please say hello to her for us. And thank you once again. Thank you once again for being on the program with us.
Absolutely. I look forward to talking to you in another 4 years.
Let's not wait so long.
Okay, sounds good.
Actress Gabrielle Stone. Her new movie is It Happened Again Last Night. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0406, and you'll find links to Gabrielle's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of It's All a Game. We'll learn a little bit about the history of board games. Plus, Stuart Nullman is along with another edition of Book Banter. And we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you. You, all you listeners out there, for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, 24-year-old Barbara Lowry was arrested for disorderly conduct in Cullman, Alabama, in May after police spotted her standing on a car, stomping out the windshield and smashing the sunroof. She said it was her boyfriend's car, that she thought he was cheating on her, and that she had spent the previous night thinking about what to do, praying about it, and stuff. However, she said, I did it anyway. So, I guess prayer for some people just isn't enough. And by the way, she did this because she merely thought her boyfriend was cheating on her. What would she have done if she had concrete proof? 24-year-old Abraham Megan admits it. I'm not very good at finances. That's a bit of a problem since he says he's a financial planner in Hollywood, Florida. Or at least he was. His boss was giving him some constructive criticism, he says, but I wasn't taking to it too well, and I was fired. This all got into the news because of who Megan was talking to, a federal judge. That's because Megan's own finances were a mess, too. Despite making good money at his job, he was $30,000 in debt, not even counting his overdrawn bank account, which he allegedly tried to solve by robbing a bank. He escaped with $10,000, the FBI says, but within an hour he had already lost $2,755 of that at a casino. Now, since that strategy failed, he allegedly robbed a second bank a week later. This time, investigators got Megan's car license and showed up at his house. Among other evidence, they found he had searched the internet for bank robbery success and failure stories. Well, welcome to the failure column, Abe. Welcome to the failure column. Just as a backup, did you ever think to search the internet for jailbreak, success, and failure stories? Might be a little too late now, huh? A manager noticed something unusual about the man loading two air conditioners into a pickup truck at the Home Depot store in Plaistow, New Hampshire. The man was wearing the famous orange apron that Home Depot employees wear, complete with a name tag that said Shannon. But as a manager, he knew nobody named Shannon worked there, so he called the police. When officers couldn't locate the man, they left, but an unmarked cruiser stayed behind. Sure enough, the man showed up again and returned to his truck. My belief is he was actually in the parking lot, walking around, watching us the whole time that we were looking for him, said Officer Patrick Schiavone. Schiavone went on to say that he claimed it wasn't his truck, this, that, and the other thing, and he went on to say that he knew nothing about air conditioners. The man, 53-year-old Bernardo Calana, denied posing as an employee, but the Home Depot apron was in his back pocket. Calana was arrested. Well, it's a good thing that he is already accustomed to wearing something orange. He might have to get very used to that in the future. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a bear with a sweet tooth ripped off the bumper of a car used to deliver donuts in Colorado, then tried to claw its way through the trunk to get inside. Moose Watch Cafe owner Kim Robertson said she and her husband discovered the bumperless car after they awoke Monday in Steamboat Springs. They initially thought it had been struck by another vehicle. Then they saw the telltale claw and paw marks. "That car just constantly smells like a rolling bakery," she said. "It's like Winnie the Pooh with honey." There were no donuts at the time in the Ford Focus, but there were some sweet-smelling aprons. After ripping off the bumper, the bear made a valiant attempt at clawing away the insulation in the trunk to get to the sweet smell inside. Now, police officer John McMartin said that he smelled donuts while standing outside the damaged vehicle. "I guess if anyone is an expert about this, it's us," he joked. Oh, I get it. A police joking about donuts. How novel. Bears are a common sight in the Colorado ski town, Robertson said. She sees several bears a year. In honor of the bear that snatched the bumper, the Moose Watch Cafe is offering an appropriate treat. Bear claws. Okay. You know what really caught my eye about this story? Apparently there are places in this world where you can get donuts delivered. I didn't know that. Who delivers donuts? Wow. I want to move there. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We all love to play board games, but have you ever given any thought to the origin of your favorite games? Tristan Donovan has. He's the author of It's All a Game, the history of board games from Monopoly to Settlers of Catan. And Tristan joins us on the line from Atlanta. Hi, Tristan.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Are you someone who is a game player by nature?
Yes, I am. It was a very big thing in our family. We used to play a lot of board games, Game of Life, Monopoly, that kind of thing. And I still play them now. I have a group of friends who live near me, and we meet up every couple of weeks to play board games in the pub. So it's very much been part of my life.
Now, most of us, when we play games, we don't think about the origin of where they came from. But as I said in the introduction, you've written the book about this. What led you down this path to find out more about the games that we all love so much?
I think I wrote a history of video games and sort of started looking into the history of board games when doing that. And one of the things that struck me about board games is they had much better stories behind them than the origins of video games. Video games are very commercially minded, whereas board games had, you know, from chess, you know, had this great big history over hundreds of years. Monopoly had this intriguing history where it started as a sort of anti-capitalist game almost, and then changed into sort of almost a celebration of capitalism. So there were lots of kind of stories behind board games that, you know, made them quite intriguing. And I wanted to sort of dig into it and find out more about, you know, how they had lasted so long. They've been around longer than the written word. So it was really interesting for me to find out, you know, why have they endured so much? Why are they so important and what they tell us about ourselves?
I came across your book by reading a story in a recent Vice article, which was focused on just the game of Monopoly, and I found that to be an amazing history when you consider the fact that the game and the very name of it means Monopoly. It's a game that celebrates capitalism, but its origins was quite the opposite.
Yeah, so it started in 1902, and it was originally called the Landlord's Game, and it was a protest really against monopolistic landlords. And the idea of the woman who created it was that people would play the game and they would see how the player who accumulated the most property managed to kind of ruin everyone else and make them bankrupt. And so she wanted a message about the injustice of people just profiting from owning land rather than doing anything from the land. Of course, it evolved from that. Some people made copies of it and variations of it, but then eventually it came together as Monopoly. But by that time, which was about 30 years later, the message had been lost. And when people played it, I mean, the message is still there. If you play the game, it's still there that one player wins and owns everything and everyone else is ruined and destitute. But people didn't really absorb that message anymore. What they took away is, I don't want to be the one who's bankrupt. I should be the rich monopolistic landlord who's draining all the money out of everyone else. So in a way, we reinterpreted it in a different way.
Now, not only does it have an interesting history in its formation as a game, but it also played a role in World War II, I understand, to help Allied troops escape.
Yes, it was quite a big thing. So the British intelligence agencies, during World War II, they wanted to help prisoners of war escape from the Nazi prisoner camps. And so what they did is they teamed up with Waddington's, who was British publisher of Monopoly, to basically make copies of the game that had sort of underneath the actual paper on the board had sort of things like compasses and files hidden inside it, really thin versions of it, and then they inserted kind of some German money into the Monopoly money, and they would send these in sort of aid parcels out to the prisoners. And this actually managed to slip under the radar of all the Nazi checks, and people did use it. So, I mean, it was found by the people in Colditz, and it helped them escape. And so it was kind of like, it would also have silk mats were inserted into it, so they could sort of work out a route to safety.
Now, the book, we've talked only about Monopoly, but the book covers the history of several games. How many games do you look into the history of in your book, It's All a Game?
Oh, well, there's probably a good couple of dozen, I would imagine. I haven't actually topped it up, but Cover Chess, Backgammon, Clue, Trivial Pursuit, Twister, Mousetrap, Operation, lots of the newer games like Pandemic and Catan. So there's quite a mixture of games in there. The Chinese game Go as well is in there. So it's quite a number. I guess maybe 30 off the top of my head. But, some will be briefer mentions and more in depth. But there's a good number of games from all the ages in there.
And what would you say is the great heyday of games? And by that I mean, when was the period of time, in any time in history, when there was a plethora of games of popular games coming out?
I suppose the sort of golden age, if you like, is the mid-20th century. So that's when you've got Monopoly, and you've got Clue, and you've got Scrabble, and the Game of Life. All these sort of iconic family games arrived around that period, from about 1930 to, I suppose, the early 70s, let's say. So I guess that's the kind of golden age where board games were selling millions and millions, and everyone was playing them, and they were hugely popular. But we're having a bit of a golden age again, although it's a bit more underground, because the way board games are designed has changed a lot. So they're not so luck-based or pure skill like chess. And there's sort of been a huge boom. I mean, there's tons of games coming out. So there might not be sort of piercing our public consciousness quite as much as Monopoly did, but they are hugely popular again, and there's a whole variety of games coming out. In a way, there's more games coming out today than there has ever been.
You say the golden age was the mid-20th century. Would you also say that with the advent of a game like Monopoly, that up until then, game makers usually thought of games as something that kids would play, but Monopoly was a game that was more or less designed for adults?
Yeah, absolutely. Monopoly was really one of the first games that connected with adults. So before then, they were all a bit like Candyland. You know, there'd be the game of the bicycle race, the game of the department store, and it would essentially boil down to roll a dice and move your counter around until you got to the end. They weren't very complicated, and Monopoly was one of the first not only to have a bit more complexity to it, but also to actually deal with themes that were more interesting for adults, like mortgages and owning property, which, you know, is probably not very appealing if you're seven.
In doing your research for the book and going through the history of games, what's the oldest game, first of all, that you've researched?
Ooh, well, it's quite hard to tell because, as I said, they existed before the written word, so it's quite vague when the earliest games are. But one of the earliest is a game called, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but Senet, which was an ancient Egyptian game, and that was already in existence by the time ancient Egypt was founded, and continued to be played there for about 3,000 years. So, you know, it's a huge period of time. Then also, there's the games of Mancala, the Mancala-type games, which are very popular in Africa. They were sort of played in sort of on boards made out of dirt or even sort of carved from wood. So They didn't really preserve very well, so no one's quite sure when they began. And they may date back even further. There's no sort of fossil record, if you like, of where they began.
And in doing your research, what was the biggest surprise, the biggest learning moment for you about the games you were talking about?
I think probably the biggest one for me was finding out about Kriegsspiel, the German war game. So this was created for military purposes to help generals plan strategies and so on. Now, I knew it existed. I knew imperial powers, and really up until sort of World War II and until computers came along, that, you know, this was used quite a lot in the military. What I didn't realize was how influential it was. So, you know, one of the big examples is Imperial Japan, when it was thinking about attacking Pearl Harbor, played a lot of games simulating the attack, and they were very divided on whether the plan would work. And the war game really did tip the balance. It basically, Pearl Harbor may not have happened if they played that war game and failed in their attack, but it worked on the board, and that gave it the momentum to make them think, yes, we're going to do this. And that changed the whole course of history. It brought the U.S. into World War II. I mean, it set the theme for the Cold War in a way. It became probably the single most important game ever played, I imagine.
Now, I meant you. You mentioned that you're a game player yourself. You get together with your friends and you play at the pub. What games do you play?
Well, we play quite a variety. So we've been playing a lot of a game called Pandemic Legacy, which is a game where you all work together to fight an outbreak of disease across the world. And it's a game that basically splits into a campaign over 12 months. And as you go, the rules change and the board changes and some of the cards get ripped up. I mean, it's quite destructive for the board. So we've been playing that quite a lot. Another game I really like playing is Twilight Struggle, which is it's quite a complex strategy game, but it simulates Cold War, and you know it's really intricate, and I love it. It's really, really good game, but it's very intimidating kind of rules.
Well, games are something that everyone enjoys, so they'll probably enjoy your book as well. The book is called It's All a Game, The History of Board Games from Monopoly to Settlers of Catan. Tristan, I thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us. I know you're sitting in an airport in Atlanta to do this interview, so I much appreciate the time you've taken to chat with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tristan Donovan, author of It's All a Game, The History of Board Games from Monopoly to Settlers of Catan. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0406, and you'll find links to Tristan's website and also either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Depending on where you live, your ability to hire someone to do something like wash your windows or take your new baby's first official pictures may be severely limited by something you've never even thought about, a haphazard patchwork of occupational licensing laws across the country. Cities and states often require professionals to take specific training or pay special fees to obtain a license. But the randomness of who is licensed and who isn't is being called anti-consumer and discriminatory by a growing chorus of bipartisan leaders. Before he left office, President Obama called for a broad-based review of these laws. Let's be fair. When a license isn't needed to protect public health, it can simply act as a barrier for people who need jobs. Among those most negatively affected by these laws are military families, who often move from state to state and find that a non-military spouse can no longer work without spending months getting a new license. It's time to fix this system. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
Stand by. Transmitting sound.
You've got a busy life with a lot going on, so let the Kelly Alexander Show keep you up to date on health and lifestyle trends, education, entertainment, and current events. Our weekly one-hour show provides you with interesting and educational information while also seeing the lighter side of life. We enjoy interviewing celebrities as well as they share their stories of struggle and success. Emmy Award winner Mia Michaels of So You Think You Can Dance, Grammy winner Jody Watley, international singing sensation Taylor Dane, and astronaut Julie Payette have all graciously appeared on our show. Don't forget that we tackle important issues as well, like breast cancer awareness, bullying, and texting while driving. There's never a dull moment on the show, so please make sure to stop by and join us. www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And coming to you from a cavernous yet chilly studio somewhere in the Big Apple is Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Who do you think I was going to be? Calvert of Forest? Via Con Deals, Dave?
Oh. Well, it's either that or you go back further to Topo Gigio. Take your pick.
Oh. Well, I'll stick with Larry Bud this time. I mean, our family names almost sound the same.
Okay.
Yes, they do. And if you didn't get the clues already on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at a book about David Letterman. Because, you know, David Letterman at best can be described as an anti-talk show host. You know, for more than 30 years on the late night TV talk show circuit, Letterman's two talk shows on NBC and CBS broke all the conventions that are usually associated with a late-night talk show, took the elements of what Tonight Show hosts Steve Allen, Jack Parr, and Johnny Carson respectively brought to the show, elements that influenced Letterman, and created a show that he tailored to his ironic, unconventional style of humor. The end result was a show that had a growing cult following thanks to segments like Stupid Pet Tricks, The Top 10 List, and Viewer Mail, and making stars out of the most ordinary and unlikely people, such as book publicist Meg Parsons, who actually met over 20 years ago. What a nice lady she is. Hack actor Larry Bud Melman, a.k.a. Calvert DeForest, and even Dave's mom. Now, in this book called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night by Jason Zinnemann, he's a critic for the New York Times, he traces the life and career of David Letterman with a great deal of thoroughness as he speaks with many of his former writers, producers, and staffers to get a portrait of an individual who carved out a brilliant career on television because he constantly went for the unconventional and proved to be a breath of fresh air as a result. Yet off the air, he was a walking bundle of insecurity, self-doubt, and self-loathing. And this book really deals with the evolution of an unconventional, one-of-a-kind TV personality who wanted to be like Johnny Carson without exactly being Johnny Carson. But if there's one unsung hero who is to be heralded in this book as to being the one who molded David Letterman into the cult figure that he is regarded as these days, and that is Meryl Marco. She's the talented comedy writer and author who was also Letterman's longtime girlfriend throughout the 1980s, and she helped create the regular segments that made Late Night with David Letterman such a popular show with viewers who wanted a break from the conventional format that The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson regularly offered, and helped earn Letterman a number of Emmy Awards during his run on NBC. Now, thanks to the influx of younger hosts like Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, and Conan O'Brien, Letterman's feelings of self-loathing grew even deeper, even when he got that lucrative deal with CBS in 1993. And it basically resulted in many of those writers basically having a diminished presence and importance on the staff, and many of them started to defect to writing staffs of hit TV shows or competing talk shows. And he preferred more celebrity interviews or his increasing abilities as a storyteller. Now, by the time the show went off the air in 2015, Letterman became more introverted, eschewed rehearsals, and basically sleepwalked through the motions as host. Even the work atmosphere at the production office was toxic, with his remaining writers and staffers subjected to lengthy post-mortem meetings following show tapings, in which Letterman just rambled on for hours with lengthy monologues about his life and insecurities.
So what now, you're saying then is that the atmosphere in the Ed Sullivan Theater, both during the day and during the show, was chilly in more ways than one.
Yeah. And it didn't even take the ghost of Ed Sullivan to even, produce that one, actually. But, you know, these days, Letterman, he's more or less living a comfortable hermit-like existence with his wife and son, and is unrecognizable with the large philosopher-style beard that he's grown since he left the show over 2 years ago. But he's recently broken his silence, so to speak, because now he's appearing on TCM, Turner Classic Movies, one of my favorite channels, as a temporary co-host with Alec Baldwin on the weekly show The Essential, seen every Saturday night.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I guess there is life after late night. But Letterman, the last giant of late night, is an absorbing study of a rather enigmatic TV personality who became an iconic figure because he set new revolutionary standards of how the late night TV talk show should be done, yet he hated every minute of it.
Mm. You mentioned his two groundbreaking talk shows. I think you forgot a third.
Are you talking about his morning show?
Absolutely.
Yes, I remember that one. I watched it when it first aired.
I watched every episode of it.
I think it didn't last for very long. I think it lasted several weeks on NBC.
Yep, but that was the seed that became his late night show.
Exactly, and that's what's written about in the book. And you know what they replaced that show with?
His morning show?
Yeah.
Wasn't that Wheel of Fortune?
Well, yeah, and then after that, Regis Philbin.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, that's a bit of TV trivia for you.
Excellent. So the book is?
Called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night by Jason Zinnemann. It's published by Harper, and it's $35.99.
And should you suggest something else in a similar vein, what would that be?
Well, the one thing I forgot to mention in my review is, remember the pitch battle he had with Jay Leno for the Control of the Tonight Show?
Yep, I had a feeling you were going to bring that up with another book.
Yeah, the one that has to be read, if you're going to read the Letterman book, is read The Late Shift by Bill Carter, which is probably one of the best books about the late night TV talk show wars. It's a definitive history. And if you want to read a little bit more, you can also read his companion book, The Battle for Late Night. But also, I recommend, speaking of The Tonight Show, which was the brass ring for Letterman that he never got, read the very first history of The Tonight Show called Tonight by Terry Galinoy. And that was published by Warner Books in paperback back in 1973. And it's a terrific history. I mean, it covers Broadway Open House, covers Steve Allen, covers Parr and Carson up to that time. It's a thin paperback, but a very well-written one at that.
Excellent. So this week's book is?
Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night by Jason Zinnemann. It's published by Harper, and it's $35.99.
And where on the end of the couch can we find you?
Well, I'm not doing a stupid pet trick, that's for sure. I'm not doing maybe a stupid journalistic trick every week in the Montreal Times in print or online at www.ntltimes.ca.
I thank you very much, Stu.
Well, you're welcome, Peter. Now, if you excuse me, I got the Velcro suit on. I'm going to just take a little jump on the trampoline onto the Velcro wall.
Yes. Again, I'm wondering what it's like for your neighbors watching what's going on in your house. Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about into the home stretch of this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you. And, of course, there is an idiot of the day waiting on the back end. Stick around for that here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Now join us at patreon.com to help us make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And you know, you can also hear this program on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Now, where were we? Oh, yeah, the Stuff File news. A patrolling police car in Union, South Carolina, noticed a car parked at an elementary school at 4 a.m. on a Saturday. He investigated, found an open door, and called for backup. Officers went in to investigate and followed the scent of burning marijuana and found two men and three women aged 24 to 29 who they detained at gunpoint. One of the men had marijuana and a gun. He was arrested on drug and weapons charges. All five were charged with burglary. All five had a consistent story. They were hunting for ghosts. Okay. But riddle me this, Batman. What good is a gun against a ghost? A woman went to use the bathroom before bed in her West Kendall, Florida home and got an unwelcome surprise. An iguana had taken up residence inside the toilet. So, what did she do? Well, she closed the lid and called 911. Lieutenant Scott Mullen of the Miami-Dade Fire Rescue Venom 1 Unit said when he got the call, he made the dispatcher make sure that it was really an iguana and not a snake. "This is the first time I've ever found an iguana in a toilet," Mullen said. Mullen arrived to the home to find the grandmother, her daughter, and grandchildren waiting for him to remove the young lizard. "I have no idea how it got there," he said. "I'm guessing it probably came up through the pipes." Mullen donned gloves and plucked the iguana from the bowl, put it in a box, and put it in his truck for a ride to a wildlife rescue center. "This is definitely a first," he said. And now that all of you have heard that story, you'll probably double-check your toilet during nightly visits, won't you? Yeah. A police officer in Daytona Beach, Florida, spotted a man driving a forklift down the street at 4 a.m. He pulled it over. It didn't have any headlights. The forklift, the officer found, had been stolen from a nearby Best Buy store, and the man, 43-year-old Bradley Barefoot, was arrested for grand theft. When asked why he was driving the machine, Barefoot shrugged and said it was, quote, "better than walking." Well, at least you have to admire his honesty, huh? And a game warden in Titus County, Texas, reported in December arresting a man for possessing a shotgun, the man's third arrest as a convicted felon with a firearm. The warden had spotted the weapon only because the man, out of the blue, approached him and asked if he wanted to inspect his hunting license, which it turned out was in order. Okay. The guy's not the brightest bulb for asking a game warden to inspect his hunting license, but the question that is more pressing to me is why a felon who's not allowed to have a firearm is able to get a valid hunting license in the first place. That's what I'd like to know. You know, for a brief shining moment, very brief, I was thinking of making this guy the idiot of the day. But like I just said, I think there's a lot of blame to go around here, so it's not really fair, and plus it's not even close to what normally qualifies for Idiot of the Day. But you've all been good, boys and girls. You've all waited patiently to the end of the program. So, without further ado, it is time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
Police say they identified a woman who robbed a Northeast Ohio video store because she gave the clerk her real phone number. Wait a minute. There are still video stores? Anyway, Akron police issued a warrant for aggravated robbery after tracing the phone number to the 41-year-old woman. A store employee says the woman walked into the store on Tuesday afternoon and shopped for a DVD. She then approached the checkout counter and gave her number to the employee to look up her account. The employee says the woman put a note on the counter stating that she had a gun. Reports show she demanded money with her hand inside her sweatshirt as if she had a weapon. Reports say the employee gave the woman an undisclosed amount of cash and she fled the store. No one was hurt. Now, it almost seems pointless to ask the usual question, oh, but I will. Why, oh, why would you give your real phone number to a store employee that you're in the process of robbing? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0406. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0406. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Evolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of... Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who rakes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.